Welcome to the PSPA podcast. I'm Helen Chapman, PSPA's Communication Manager, and today on the podcast, we will be covering the sensitive subject of brain donation. Brain donation enables researchers to learn more about the brain and reasons why it might degenerate, which includes conditions such as PSP and CBD. To help myth bust brain donation and explain more about it and the difference valuable donations can make, I am speaking to our research coordinator, Megan Hodgson, and Rory Tugman-Smith, who works at the Parkinson's UK Brain Bank at the Imperial College London. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And very nice to be here.
So before we start delving into the subject of brain donations, I was wondering if you could both say a little bit about what you do at PSPA and also at the Parkinson's UK Brain Bank, please.
Sure. So I'm Megan Hodgson. I'm the research coordinator for PSPA. I've been with the charity for just over 2 years now, and had previously worked at University College London Hospitals, working on the PROSPECT study, which is a PSP and CBD longitudinal research study. I look after all things research at PSPA, which includes topic of brain donation, and really excited to have a quick chat about it today.
And my name is Rory Tugman-Smith. I'm the Tissue Bank Engagement Manager at the Parkinson's UK Brain Bank, also known as the MS Society Tissue Bank, also known as the MS and Parkinson's Tissue Bank. And we're based over at Imperial College. I've been in this role for 2 years. And what the role largely involves is all the processes of the tissue bank outside the four walls of the laboratory. And a lot of my role is help coordinating with different teams around the country to make brain donations possible.
Thank you. So to get started on this subject, I was wondering if we could just cover, first of all, what brain donation actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. A big question, but an important one for this topic. Brain donation is similar to other sort of donation schemes that happen after someone passes away, in the sense that we have to adhere to certain sets of certificates needing to be complete and that sort of thing. But we need our own set of consent forms to allow someone to donate specifically for research. And what brain donation is it's the donation of the brain and sometimes the spinal cord, and sometimes the cerebrospinal fluid. And that's the fluid that the brain is sort of sitting in. The purposes of brain donation, especially to somewhere like Parkinson's UK Brain Bank, is to support research. We're not facilitating donations just for them to sit on a laboratory wall or something like that that you may have seen in a pathology museum. Everything we do is to help enhance research into PSP, CBD, Parkinson's related disorders, so that we can understand these conditions better, so that we can then treat these conditions better.
Fabulous. That's a great explanation. And if someone was interested in brain donating to help aid research, like, how would someone sign up to do that?
Good question. And like everything in medicine, there's a consent form involved. Someone wants to make sure it's what you really want to do. And what we want to make sure by doing that is that you read through our donor information leaflet, you have a look at what we have available online about what brain donation involves. And then after that happens, three forms need to be completed. They're each just one page, A4 page. And one is for the person who wants to donate their tissues to research, sort of a consent for the procurement of tissue. One is for their next of kin. And now that can be a close friend, family member, solicitor, GP, even. The reason we request this is because we're not an embedded NHS service. And so when a donor passes away, we need to be notified. And so it's important that conversation is had with someone else in your life. And then the third form is a short little bit about your medical history, so that we can know who your GP surgery is, perhaps when you were diagnosed, your first symptoms, things that might not be readily available on a medical record. Because When we receive a donation, we will request medical records to inform that donation, but I'm sure everyone can appreciate not everything is recorded on there.
And is this a common process that all brain banks would follow, or would it vary from brain bank to brain bank?
No, absolutely. And it'll always be a very similar process. Essentially, what we want to make sure we have from people who want to donate to research is informed consent. And so, what will tend to happen is we'll want to make sure people understand what brain donation is before they're signing up for it. And then there will have to be a formal process of signing up for it and completing some forms. After that, there are many sort of optional extra steps like completing maybe additional questionnaires. Maybe every 2 years you'll receive something, say, this is what my symptoms are. And so you can explain that to us. And so we can have a record of that. There, with most brain banks, there won't be any sort of extra clinic appointments or anything like that. It's very similar to other donation schemes where it's sort of a pledge to donate, and then we'll keep in contact and keep you informed in the sort of research we're supporting, but there's no additional sort of burden.
And I know you mentioned this before around other organ donation. So this is a completely separate process to other organ donation processes. So if you want to become a brain donor, you can't just sign up to become an organ donor.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the best way to think of it is when it comes to, obviously there's schemes like donating blood and that sort of thing that you'll do in life. But when it comes to post-mortem donation, to medical research or medical teaching, there's three schemes really. There is the one that you may have sort of ticked on your driving license, which is NHS organ donation and transplant. And that is tends to be around when someone may pass away and they'll have a healthy kidney, say, and someone else needs a kidney. And if you've not opted out of that scheme, they may then approach the family and say, would this be something of interest? Can we help facilitate this? That sort of thing. So that's already sort of signed up for if you've ticked the box on your driver's license. Then you have whole body donation to medical research or medical teaching. And that will normally be done through local medical schools. And medical schools will look after that and they'll facilitate the clues in the name, the donation of the whole body. And what that's normally to do is to teach medics about anatomy and physiology before they may then approach patients in life, as it were. And then we can work with both those schemes, which I can maybe touch on a little bit later, but then we're a separate scheme in of itself. Different set of forms and everything else, and we're donation to research. The reason why we're a little bit different is because we're collecting specific tissues and for a different purpose, for normally research into a condition. And we're also requesting whole medical records. And that's a really important step of brain donation so that we can actually understand how what someone's experiencing in life and how that is then reflected in their donation.
And leading on from that, so does someone's medical history then determine which kind of brain bank might be best suited for where your donation is sent?
Absolutely. And so there's quite a few brain banks in the UK, and I would hazard a guess at around 17, but that is by no means a definite number. And they tend to be differentiated by which condition maybe they're doing research into, which charity is funding them to enable that donation, that sort of thing. And so we primarily are funded by, well, solely funded by MS Society and Parkinson's UK. So we have funding to facilitate donations from people with either of those conditions. And with Parkinson's, it's anything under that umbrella term of a Parkinsonism or a Parkinson's disorder. And we then are also funded to make sure that we can do those donations across the UK. So that might be another limitation with other brain banks where they may be geographically located and that sort of thing. And then they may also have additional eligibility criteria based on someone's clinical history. We aren't so much geographically restrictive, but we do have that slight clinical history criteria.
So, just to clarify that you mentioned that your brain bank takes people who have been diagnosed with an umbrella term of Parkinsonism. So that would, just to clarify, that would include PSP and CBD.
Absolutely. And sorry, I should be more clear on that. And that's it. So anyone who's been diagnosed with Parkinson's, or Parkinson's disease with dementia, or dementia with Lewy bodies, anyone with multiple system atrophy, anyone with progressive supranuclear palsy, PSP, or anyone with corticobasal degeneration, CBD. We will accept donations from all of those conditions. They have different pathologies, but they are in similar disorders that we're sort of funded to do research into.
In terms of other brain banks in the UK, would the brains they accept with the criteria differ? So, would there be some brain banks that wouldn't accept PSP or CBD brains?
Correct. And there will be some with a focus on Alzheimer's, perhaps, some with a focus on epilepsy. It'll be different sort of neurological conditions that they'll tend to have a focus on. What's important to note is also we would like to encourage people without neurological conditions to donate as well. They're just as important donations.
Well, fab. Thank you.
I think it would be really good to highlight that our helpline team have a list of brain banks across the UK that do accept PSP and CBD brains. So if you're interested in brain donation, you can always speak to our helpline. They've got that list ready to go.
So now we have covered what brain donation is and how someone could sign up if they wish to donate their brain. I was wondering if we could now have a look at why brain donations are so important to PSP and CBD research and how the brain tissue donated is used.
Absolutely. And I think the main, it's a very easy answer to say, but the research doesn't happen without brain donation. We as a research service exist because of a research need to look at the brain when it has the conditions of PSP or CBD in this case. And that is incredibly important because without understanding what is occurring in the tissue, we can't understand what the condition truly is or how to treat it. And so I like to sort of look at some examples of some of the things that we've achieved in other conditions, particularly at this brain bank. And so on our MS Society Tissue Bank side, it was through donated tissue to research that brains of individuals with diagnosed with MS were examined, and they were found to have a particular feature, basically these B cell follicles, which then said, what's this? Perhaps this is a target for us to explore for treatment. It was explored. It is now one of the most common disease modifying treatments there are for MS. On the side of Parkinson's, it's through examination of the human brain post-mortem that we first understood that the substantia nigra is a hallmark area for sort of Parkinson's, where there's this loss of neurons there. Turns out those neurons are producing dopamine. And so perhaps if we give these individuals a dopamine treatment, this will help. It's these sort of steps that we're trying to do by looking at the donated tissue that people pledge. And it's only through brain donation that we can make these leaps.
Wow. I think it's really important to kind of cover some of that information you've just shared, just because it's just the power that difficult decision to donate a brain might be able to help researchers achieve.
No, that's it. And I think it's a very unique decision, and it is by no means for everyone. You know, there are plenty of medics who themselves may not want to donate their brain for whatever reason they have, and that is perfectly acceptable. But there is a wealth of research that can be done and achieved through the efforts of brain donation. And so, where people feel it's appropriate, we strongly encourage it.
So I don't know if you can answer this, but how many studies could the tissue from one donated brain assist?
It's a complex question because it depends on what the research is and all that sort of thing. But suffice to say that when we receive a brain donation, that is processed in such a manner that it can create up to 250 samples for research. And from those samples, per se, we can take several slides that will end up sort of on a microscope slide for analysis. And so we would, you could say, it could support up to 250 studies. In reality, that's not quite true, but each donation can support comfortably 10 research projects, if not more.
Wow, that is
And
quite
Rory,
powerful.
those samples, they're not just used within the UK, that's correct. They could
No.
be sent abroad and they could be used for studies at the other side of the world.
Exactly that. And so ourselves, MS and Parkinson's Tissue Bank, we've collaborated with 27 different countries across six different continents. And we that's sort of the beauty of the tissue bank, not so much for the international projects. They do need to do a certain different set of things to apply for tissue for us. But for projects within the UK where we're all working under the same ethical framework, what we're able to do is actually allow researchers to apply to us with a research idea, and then it's reviewed by scientific peers and people living with Parkinson's and MS to see, is this research project in the interest of individuals affected by these conditions? Is it scientifically sound? And then if it is, we can release that tissue. That researcher, without the resource that is the tissue bank or brain donation, would have to apply for ethics themselves, would have to consent individuals, would have to unfortunately wait for those individuals to pass away, would then need to have some system to collect these tissues. And you can see that would be at least an 8-year project in of itself. And that's sort of what brain donation does, is it expedites research, and without it, the research just wouldn't happen.
I think that really helps to put in perspective the impact donations can have. Thank you. So, are you aware of which PSP and CBD research is currently using brain tissue and what this research has helped to achieve so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So we at Imperial have quite a few research projects focusing on these conditions, but that wouldn't happen without the human tissue, let's be clear. But a lot of interesting research is also happening over in North America at the moment. And what we're really doing with in collaboration with sort of clinical cohorts like the Prospect study that Megan mentioned earlier, is we're providing the final sort of clinical audit step to these studies that are trying to do things with people in life. And what we're providing is essentially, I always like to think of it as a dartboard without any numbers on it. And if we aren't able to define what the condition is, and if we aren't able to say exactly how different subtypes are different from one another at a pathological level, then we are sort of shooting at a dartboard without knowing what score we're getting. The pathology that is being looked at now is basically trying to say, okay, we're going to look at donated brains from people with different subtypes. We're going to then see how the condition looks different in each of these people's brains. We're going to map how they are different to one another so that then we can have a better diagnosis and treat these people differently according to what their diagnosis is. And that's a little bit vague, I understand, of an explanation, but that's what we're really trying to do with brain donation and the research from it in PSP and CBD, is really trying to get to grips with a better definition of what it is and what those subtypes are.
I think that's a really good explanation because, as we know, you if you're diagnosed with PSP or you're diagnosed with CBD, we're not 100% sure what that pathology is going to be at the end. That you might be living with PSP and those symptoms of PSP, but at postmortem, it's actually a CBD pathology that's in the brain. And if we can better understand or come up with a test that would confirm that pathology in life, clinical trials would be so much easier because you could be treating someone for one pathology and they actually have a different one, which isn't good for clinical trial statistics at all.
No, exactly that. And that's the, brain donation is part of this sort of wider thing of biobanking. Essentially, people donating tissues to research to help make it better. It may not be a clinical trial, may not have a defined endpoint. It's basically so there's a collection of samples that people can then do research on. And in other conditions, like say someone who may have a liver cancer, they will attend a hospital site, they will have blood tests, they will maybe have a biopsy of their liver. That will be analyzed by the laboratory in the hospital, will have a definitive diagnosis, and they'll be able to do work there. In brain conditions, that work, that biopsy doesn't necessarily happen, and that's the void that brain donation is filling.
So I know that our community is really passionate about progressing research, but from our discussion, realizing that brain banks tend to cover a range of conditions rather than just specific to PSP and CBD. So if someone listening to this podcast has listened to some of the research that can be progressed as a result of brain donation, it makes them think, actually, yes, I want to go ahead, I want to sign up for this. Could they request for their brain once it is donated and received to be used for specific condition research?
Of course, absolutely, and that's somewhat inherent to the donor themselves. If someone is donating and they have a neurological condition, their research, their donation will only be used for research of the neurological condition they have. For individuals who may not have a neurological condition, a what we would term a control donor who wants to donate, they can specify that I would like this to be maybe focused on this type of research, absolutely, and that's sort of why we have these different donation schemes. We have the MS Society Tissue Bank, we have the Parkinson's UK Brain Bank. The hope is, and the reason why we accept donations from anyone under that umbrella term sort of thing, is we hope that research in one of these conditions is going to help improve research across all of these conditions. But people will always be able to say, no, I specifically want to support this type of research.
Can they go a step further and request that it is their brain tissue is used for a specific study or a specific goal?
It will be difficult to say a specific study. The hope is that when people donate to research, they sort of donate to the tissue bank or the brain bank itself, and then they sort of let the brain bank be a custodian of their generous donation. And that's why we have that peer review process where tissue users or researchers will apply to the tissue bank saying what their research is and what they want to do, and then we will only supply them with tissue that is relevant for their study. And so that's where that is sort of saying it's inherent to who is donating anyway. If they have a neurological condition, it will always be for that neurological condition, the research that is done. But there won't always be a specific end goal or study point that they can specifically donate to.
And once the brain has been donated and it's starting to be used for studies, will the person's family be kept up to date with any of the research that the brain tissue is being used for?
Of course. And so with every donation we receive, the first thing that happens is we have to do a diagnostic workup. And that's sort of what we touched on earlier. And that will sort of have to go through certain processes in the lab. And then a neuropathologist will also have to look at the tissue and make their diagnosis. That report will then first and foremost be available to the family. And in often cases, that can be quite an important step so people can have that closure on what exactly was the condition that my loved one had? To what severity was it? Were there other factors at play? And that sort of thing. And then once that's available, that is basically saying that that donation is now available for research as well. We can't release tissue before that. And at that point, we then really encourage family members to keep in touch. And when they call, we can basically give them a bit of an update on the type of research that donation has supported. We can't always say specific studies because we don't want individuals to be able to sort of approach researchers directly, but we'll always be able to speak through the type of research that the donation is supporting.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think it can help people with their processing to know the final diagnosis, but also people don't lose interest, do they, in the research even after their loved one's gone. They still have the same hopes for progressing research into the conditions because of their own experiences. So I think being able to stay in touch with how things are moving forward is really important. So, how does someone action a brain donation? So we've talked a bit about like what the process is for signing up. and also like the difference the research can make from the donations. But if, say, a loved one has signed up for to donate their brain and then they pass away, how does their family action their wishes?
So we've got a dedicated emergency sort of phone number to be able to facilitate donations, and we accept calls 365 days of the year for that. And so the first step is when someone who wants to donate their brain or spinal cord to research passes away, or even if they are seen to be sort of approaching end of life, that number can be called, and you'll normally 9 times out of 10 get through to me, as I am the individual who helps coordinate that process. And I'll then be able to take some details, and I'll be able to reassure the individual what the process is and what's going to happen. From that point, we as a tissue bank team look to look after the entire process for the family. It's an incredibly stressful time already, and we don't want to add to that burden. The process for us to enable the donation to research essentially requires someone to be taken into the care of a funeral director, and then for a death certificate to be completed by the GP surgery and an independent doctor called the medical examiner. That death certificate is called the MCCD, the medical certificate for cause of death, and that's what legally needs to be completed before the donation can happen. And we will then liaise with the GP and the medical examiner to make sure they're aware of the urgency. We'll speak with the funeral director to make sure they know what they need to do. And then we'll also speak with the local hospital to where that person is living, so that everything will occur locally. And then we have a good relationship with a lot of the hospitals around the country, and we'll then enable that donation to happen there. And after the donation has occurred, all within 48 hours after someone has passed away, we'll also then arrange for a medical courier to take those tissues from wherever in the UK they are, to us in London.
Thank you. That's a good point to pull out is around the transportation of the brain. We did recently a poll around brain donation on our social media channels, just trying to gauge what might be some barriers around why people might not want to sign up to donate their brain. And I think one of the things, like as you picked up on, is like the family are going through a difficult and stressful time as it is. There's all these questions about how would the body or the brain be transported to the brain bank, and who's actually responsible for organizing all that. But essentially what you've said is that it is all kind of sorted for them.
Exactly that. It requires almost, six different teams all pulling in the same direction, and it's quite heartwarming how seamless that goes. People are willing to do quite a lot to make sure that these donations can be fulfilled. And one of my favorite sort of examples is from an individual who passed away in a very remote part of Scotland, and the funeral director decided to that it was no hassle at all to drive 3.5 hours in one direction to make sure that that donation can happen. And so that it's quite phenomenal the efforts people will make, and we're there in the middle to make sure that everyone knows what they need to do and how quickly they need to do it.
So it's a massive decision and commitment for a family to make that decision to have a loved one's brain donated. But that whole kind of commitment and dedication is followed through by the people who make sure that those wishes are put into place. That's lovely to hear. Another barrier that people kind of mentioned on the social media poll was around the practicalities of removing the brain, and the worry that their loved one's appearance might change. Do you have any information about that that might put people's minds at
Of
ease?
course, yeah. And it's a very valid concern. And people will, of course, want to sort of honor their loved one in a multitude of different ways. And there's a range of funeral sort of arrangements that people may want. And I can give assurance that should someone wish to donate their brain to research, it is done in such a way by, medically trained professionals such that an open casket funeral could still go ahead after brain donation. Not to be, too detailed, but essentially what will remain is a small incision at the back of the head, and the funeral directors will be very comfortable with what they need to do to ensure someone is still presented as you would hope to have them presented.
Thank you. And I think you've kind of answered the last question I had, which again came through from families that were responding to us on social media around this subject. And I think there was a fear from one family that they might not be able to hold a proper funeral for their loved one. Is that still possible?
Absolutely. And I think where a bit of confusion comes through there is sort of what I was talking about with those different types of donation to research. And so if someone donates their whole body to medical schools and that sort of thing, then they may not receive that loved one back. They may do, but 6 months later and that sort of thing. And that's where often those sort of anecdotes will come from. But that is different from sort of donation of the brain and spinal cord to research.
Thank you. This has been a really interesting discussion. Megan, is there anything you would like to add at this point?
I think it would be really good to hear from Rory. What are, if someone's thinking about donating their brain, what are the kind of like three most important things that that person needs to do and think about kind of early on in the process? Or I've heard that it's quite difficult. It's more difficult to arrange a donation if someone has not consented in life.
That's it. And so with these things, it's never an easy conversation to have about end of life and sort of care planning and that sort of thing all around it, but it is an incredibly important conversation to have. I mean, there are other sort of great initiatives that, the Dying Matters initiative, and because it does, and making sure one has their orders, their affairs in order for them is really important because it's a stressful time for the family. And what I would recommend in that is that if it's something that you feel you would wish to do, to donate to research after you pass away, is to have that conversation early on with your family. And because it's not a conversation that's easy, and it's not a decision that you'll often take on your own. And many people will say, I would be happy to donate, but I understand my loved one isn't happy with it, and they won't donate for that reason, and that is perfectly fine. But it's important to have these conversations early on so that you can plan for that. If you then decide, it's really important to then engage with the local brain bank in your area so that you can ensure that you've done what you need to do, complete the documents and that sort of thing, and then they can make sure you have all the information you need to make sure the donation goes successfully. And the third sort of thing, I guess, is to just remember that it is your decision. It's a completely unique decision, but it is your decision. And you can decide to donate and withdraw later on. That's also fine as well. You can withdraw at any time. So it's something important to consider, and I encourage all those who feel that they can to donate, but it's your decision to make and to discuss with your family.
Where would someone normally be approached about brain donation? Is it a conversation that happens through a GP or through a neurologist or?
And unfortunately, there is no exact point. There is no sort of spot in someone's care journey where they say, oh, we should talk about brain donation now, unfortunately. So we rely on people talking about it, and we rely on medical professionals bringing it up with patients at the right time. And that's why I sort of hope, people may listen to this podcast and just have a think, talk about it. See if it's something they would be interested in doing. There is no time that they'll necessarily be approached.
Well, thank you very much, Megan and Rory. It's been a very interesting discussion, and I hope for anyone out there who perhaps has had the topic of brain donation raised to them recently, or it's something they've come across themselves and have been considering, hopefully we've helped to answer a few of the questions that might be burning in your mind. If you do want to learn more about possibly donating your brain or where your local brain bank is, please do get in touch with the PSPA helpline. You can contact them on 0300 0110 122, or you can email helpline at pspassociation.org.uk.